Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 15th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we're bringing you a segment of our most recent Off the Hill political panel, which took place Thursday, April 14th, on the theme, Will Budget 2022 Build Canada Forward? Co-hosting the event was former NDP Deputy Leader and House Leader Libby Davies and founder of the 613-819 Black Hub, Robin Brown. Our special guests included MP Leah Gazan, filmmaker Avi Lewis, and economist and the director of the Center for Future Work, Jim Stanford. It was a high-powered panel. Here's a snippet of last night's event. Take a listen.
Signs of concrete action to address the climate emergency were hoped for in this budget, but climate has seemed to take a back seat in government priorities, with fossil fuel companies using the war in Ukraine to urge expansion of operations. And in fact, the day before the budget, the government announced they were going to move forward with a $12 billion Bay du Nord offshore drilling project off the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador. So, Avi, what do you make of the government's contradictory stance, given their stated commitment to climate change?
Thank you, Libby. It's a pleasure to be here with you all. I'm coming to you from Whilkwai, otherwise known as Half Moon Bay, on Shishal territory on the West Coast. Look, what you're describing is part of a pattern. And I think it's worth zooming out as part of this conversation about the budget to look at the pattern. And when it comes to climate, I think the only way you can honestly put it is that the Trudeau Liberals have an abusive relationship with the truth. And this is a pattern going back many years. Let's just rewind a second to 2015 and the Paris Accords, and Trudeau just elected, Canada's back. And there was this sense that the Harper years were over and now we were going to have a climate serious government. And then for the next 4 years, he insisted that we could only have a climate deal in Canada if we had a new tar sands pipeline. So, like, people aren't stupid. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is national gaslighting. There's no other way to say it. It's contortionist logic. And unfortunately, the corporate media were utterly complicit in those years. And so we wasted precious years of decade zero on the climate block, arguing about whether or not we could have a new tar sands pipeline and still have a legit climate strategy. In 2019, that contortionist logic reached its peak when they declared a climate emergency one day and bought that pipeline the next. It's the same pattern of utterly contradictory messages. And our emissions keep going up and up and up. And then the 2021 election last year, on the basis of the analysis and carefully planted political narrative validated by a couple of partisan climate scientists, the Liberals won the narrative that they had the best climate plan of all the parties. They won the election, partly on the strength of winning that narrative, and they immediately launched their new gaslighting campaign, which we're still in. Now the message box is, we can increase fossil fuel production and export while we lower emissions from the fossil fuel sector. So as we lead up to the budget, just a couple of weeks ago, at the end of March, the Liberals released their emissions reduction plan. I think it's important to just footnote quickly here that the Bill C-12, the Climate Accountability Act, which the NDP won important changes to in committee and in the negotiation round in the last minority parliament, that law now requires the Liberals to submit a plan in advance of climate targets, and the NDP got a 2025 climate target, which means that in 2022 they have to release their plan. So that was the plan that we saw last month, and there were some very important parts of it, like they mapped out sector by sector how much we have to cut emissions to reach our insufficient but still, you know, important goals. And in the emissions reduction plan, they show that there'll be a 56% increase in tar sands production this decade while we cut emissions from the fossil fuel sector by 40% in theory in the same period. So when we come to the budget and they approve Bay du Nord, another multi-billion dollar fossil fuel project one day, and then they have a budget with a lot of hoopla about $9 billion worth of climate spending the next day, this is part of exactly the same pattern. And when you look at that new climate spending and the new climate measures in the budget, the lion's share is another handout to extend the life of the fossil fuel industry with carbon capture utilization, the most neglected letter in the acronym, carbon capture utilization and storage. This is a false solution. The entire environmental and climate community in Canada has demanded, hundreds of academics, thousands of organizations. It is a bald extension of a new subsidy to the fossil fuel industry, which will extend its life, which will allow it to continue to increase emissions, all the while we're supposed to believe that they're going to come down. So these mixed messages have had, I think, a profound effect on our society, and the budget is a continuation of this. People are confused. They get these mixed messages. New fossil fuel projects, new pipelines, and all of these contradictory messages, and they think we're doing something, but so everything is okay, but it's not okay. They say it's not okay, but we're still doing the same things. In fact, we're doing more of them. So the public is confused, but these messages do have an audience. And that audience is the oil and gas industry. And the message to them from the Trudeau Liberals has always been and continues to be, don't worry about it. The status quo can continue. And that's a travesty. So now we're a super emitting pariah among rich countries. And the hard truth is that that won't change as these folks in this logic are in power.
Well, just a very quick follow-up, Abby. I think you've shown how one contradictory the government's narrative is and how they're how they're targeting different audiences for different things, but also how complicated it is, and for the average person to wade through all of that, even just what you just said, and you're a guy who's right on the money, you're right up there monitoring this, and it says to me that we're in a time where it's more important than ever that accountability, whether it's through the NDP, the opposition, whether it's through NGOs, the activist community, is more important to ever. Otherwise, we never really know what the truth is. It's more important than ever to get that.
There is a truth. And Libby, it is intentionally confusing, but the real truths are actually pretty simple. And Jim has done incredible work, and Lee has done incredible work outlining that the fossil fuel sector, while it occupies this paramount place in the national narrative, is not a huge part of our economy. We can take care of those workers without taking care of those giant extractive corporations. The plans have been in place for years, and a just transition is perfectly within grasp, but we can't have a just transition unless there's actually a transition going on. And that means deep slashes to emissions, and that is just not going to happen as long as they prolong this industry.
Yeah, over to you, Robin.
Yeah. You mentioned workers there, Abby. And so Paul Taylor, who was supposed to be with us, has opened a national discussion on new ways of thinking about work. So this is a question for all of you. We want to ask you about what was in the budget for workers, because this is something on the minds of many as a result of the pandemic, obviously, and of course, pre-pandemic with the growth of the gig economy. So how does the budget hold up there? Were there any substantive commitments for workers? And why don't we start with Jim?
Sure, Robin. Thank you. I mean, the one thing that's good for workers is that this budget was not an austerity budget at all. It, in fact, increased spending with some incremental programs, incremental programs that obviously the NDP helped to negotiate under the terms of this new confidence and supply arrangement. Contrary to some of the claims from conservatives and bankers that we had to cut spending deeply in order to get the budget closer to balance. In fact, the government increased spending, including $5 billion for this dental care rollout. That will be important, and a number of other initiatives. Of course, there's still a lot more to do. We all would have liked to see more on the pharmacare side. That would have been very important for working people. And I'm sure that Jagmeet is negotiating as much as he can with the Liberals to try and concretize some of the commitments in that regard. The main thing from my perspective at kind of the macroeconomic level, the 1,000-foot macroeconomic level, was the general stance of this budget was not austerity. It was in fact heading a little bit in the other direction. And I think this fiscal stance is a positive one that will reinforce some of the progress that we've seen in labor markets and wages and so on as Canada continues to recover. You know, all of us have questions about the Liberals, of course, and none of us would trust the Liberals as far as we could throw them. But this supply and confidence arrangement and the political pressure that we've been able to mobilize around it means this is, a positive general budget, notwithstanding some of the problems in specific areas, such as climate change.
Well, you know, I would argue that in many ways, this was an austerity budget. I think, you know, we saw an increase of expenditures, which included $8 billion increase to the military. But there's other areas where this budget falls short. Certainly, it was not a budget compared to the last budget, which had over $100 billion in net new spending over 5 years. This budget has just $31 billion, in fact, in net new spending over the next 5 years. And despite the government's claim to be a feminist government, this budget certainly wasn't a feminist budget. And their own report actually revealed that on gender and diversity, it showed that 44% of the budget measures will benefit men and women equally, with 42% of that directly or indirectly benefiting men. So how does that impact work? I think a perfect example of this budget's neglect is the neglect of the caring economy. I mean, we just came through a pandemic. People putting their lives on the front lines and in industries like healthcare, long-term care, where's the money in the budget for this? And personal support work that's mainly dominated by women. And, you know, where do we see increases in the budget? You know, I heard throughout the pandemic, you know, shout outs to healthcare workers, calling healthcare workers heroes, but that certainly wasn't reflected in this budget. And I'll give you an example. I mean, you know, Avi pointed to it. I think there's nothing easier to keep than a Liberal broken promise. But Justin Trudeau promised $100.8 billion over 4 years to raise the wages of PSWs to at least 45 an hour and to train 50,000 more. But where is this commitment in the budget? Nowhere to be found. So, you know, I think certainly the fact that we are still in the pandemic, certainly there was no reflection in the budget for workers is very evident. But, you know, going back to what Paul has fought for very hard as something that we have in common, a guaranteed livable basic income. You know, we know that we need to start redefining what work is, including unpaid care work, mostly performed by women. You know, in the care economy, or people that can't work because of various reasons. People, we know that 70% of people with intellectual disabilities, adults, 70% live in poverty. People with complex mental health and trauma or invisible disabilities that may be able to work, you know, 1, 2, 3 days a week, but might not be able to work 40 days a week. We need to start looking after people. And I thought I didn't really see in this budget a focus on people. I continue to see a focus on big business. A one-time tax certainly doesn't cut it. I was hoping to see a budget that was really focused on people, particularly talking about how we didn't want to go back to the normal. It appears that the Liberal government does want to go back to normal.
Where is the Canada Disability Benefit?
Yeah,
that was
none.
A bill that nope. died on the order paper in
yeah,
the last parliament.
Nowhere to be found. Nowhere in the budget.
I feel I'm in a tiny bit of a time warp here. I'm not gonna take over the hosting, but I feel like we got a possible episode of Counterspin here because I want to dig into this just a tiny bit, if Robin and Libby, if it's okay with you. Was this an austerity budget or was it not? Like I'm undecided and I'm really interested to hear more from Jim. The framing of it, Chrystia Freeland framed it as an austerity budget. They got part of it there. They emphasized that the debt to GDP ratio was going to go down over time. They emphasized that the tap, you know, the faucet was slowly closing. Yes, there was new spending, right? And yes, in historic terms, there was new spending. But as Leah says, we're still in a pandemic. The spending is half what it was last year, and the need is only greater. So are they, like, is there a difference, Jim, in your view, between the narrative of an austerity budget and the reality of where government spending is in historic terms, or what? Because I'm just not sure.
Well, Avi, thank you for asking me. Counterspin. We should redo counterspin. I'm all for that. Let's get counterspin rejuvenated. Unravel. I love it. There's all kinds of things that need to be done. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Now, the finance minister is always communicating to the Bay Street and to the markets and everything to try and indicate that she's being prudent. And the so-called guardrail that she has put on the budget is this debt to GDP ratio. Now, that is a pretty soft guardrail, and the finance community knows it. Okay, the financial markets are not convinced by her rhetoric that they're doing this, and most of them have been critical that she's still spending too much. And the debt to GDP ratio is falling, mostly because the economy is growing like gangbusters. And in both real terms, in terms of job creation, we had a very positive job number last week. And in terms of inflation, you know, the reality is inflation has two sides to it, and it hurts workers if wages don't keep up, but it certainly generates big income. It generates big revenues for governments, and it reduces the real value of debt burdens. So these, in a way, are all things we've been fighting for since the 1990s, when the Bank of Canada went into a whole disinflation exercise, and we paid for it through a lost decade. So in macroeconomic terms, there is no way that you can describe this as austerity. It just is not credible. Now, does that mean that there are lots of other things that this government can and should be doing? 100%. And we've listed several of them: pharmacare, disability benefit, the climate investments, and so on. On the other hand, I think we do ourselves a disservice if we underestimate the amount of influence that we've had on this direction. The government spent big during the COVID recession, and they're still spending big, not as big as they need to, but we shouldn't sell ourselves short, particularly in the context of this confidence and supply arrangement, where the NDP has, I think, done a tremendous service to Canadians to show that they can lever more commitment to important things and keep it headed that way. But it is not perfect, absolutely not, and we have to fight loudly and actively on the issues where it falls short, 100%.
Well, that we're going to go from the macro picture that you've just put forward, Jim, and I'm going to come back to you, Leah, but just before I do, I want to quickly go back to Robin and kind of get back to sort of the impact of the budget on different communities. And Robin, you just published a piece on Rabble this week, actually, on the impact of the budget on the Black community. So I think it would be great if you could just give us a few of your observations on what you felt about the budget as it impacted the Black community.
There were some things in there that we liked, that the community liked, that were good. For instance, there's $3.7 million for a Black-led engagement design and implementation of a mental health fund for Black federal public servants, right? And as you may know, in December 2020, a group of Black federal public servants brought a class action suit against the government, right? And they actually called for this. So they got that, although they even said that this is a great start, but not not enough, and it's gonna take 4 years, and people are really struggling now with their mental health, right? Because of the what they're enduring at work. Then there was the $50 million for the Supporting Black Canadians Communities Initiative to continue like empowering Black-led and Black-serving community organizations, which sounds good until you realize that it's just $25 million a year to support all Black organizations across the country, which seems kind of woefully inadequate. But one of the biggest omissions, though, was that there's no money to specifically collect data nationally on the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 of the pandemic on Black Canadians. And this is despite the mounting evidence of how Black Canadians were disproportionately how they got sick or were killed by COVID because they worked in long-term care homes as personal support workers or in Amazon warehouses or driving Ubers, right? And how Black businesses, many of which were already struggling, failed during COVID, right? So the government's 2021 budget had $172 million to enhance the government's ability to collect data specifically on diverse populations, but without specifically allotting some of that money to study the pandemic impact on Black Canadians, it's unlikely that any of it will be, right? But then there's another big one, and that was there was $85 million in there for what they called a new anti-racism strategy and a national action plan on combating hate, right? And this strategy would essentially combine the government's efforts to combat systemic discrimination, including systemic anti-Black racism, with the government's efforts to combat which is what they call hate, right? Now, the problem is that systemic discrimination and what they mean by hate, which isn't really well defined, are fundamentally different, right? Systemic discrimination like that faced by Black and Indigenous folks in Canada refers to discrimination by state bodies like the police, schools, and healthcare system, and private institutions like banks and employers, resulting in disproportionate numbers of Black and Indigenous people being jailed, disproportionate numbers of Black and Indigenous people, disproportionate number of Black and Indigenous students being suspended, expelled, and streamed into non-academic courses, and worse health outcomes for Black and Indigenous folks. So although a recently released StatsCan hate crimes report showed that Black Canadians, in fact, faced the most hate crimes of any group in 2020, systemic anti-Black racism is the far worse and fundamental problem. And this isn't to say that hate crimes and hate groups aren't big problems and shouldn't be addressed. They are and they should, but they aren't examples of systemic discrimination or systemic anti-Black racism. So the government should keep those separate, because history shows that when things like that are combined, addressing anti-Black racism tends to fall to the bottom, right? So instead, the government should create, I've heard Black folks call for this, a special envoy on combating systemic anti-Black racism, like the ones that this budget funds for combating anti-Semitism and Islamophobia.
Okay, thanks very much.
That was a segment from our latest Off the Hill political panel, which took place on Thursday, April 14th, 2022. Thanks for all who attended, and if you missed the panel last night and would have liked to attend, keep your eyes out for our next panel happening in May. Don't forget to register ahead of that event to have your chance to ask questions to our panelists. Now it's time for a segment we call In Case You Missed It. This week, Rabble writers and contributors dissected the recently released federal budget. Stephen Wenzel breaks down how the federal budget addressed the housing crisis. Budget 2022 makes plans to double the rate of new units over the next 10 years and develop about 200,000 new houses annually. The budget also includes a new housing accelerator fund, a project built to increase supply while expanding the availability of affordable housing. And when it comes to eradicating homelessness, the budget proposes $562.2 million over 2 years to continue providing doubled annual funding for Canada's homelessness strategy. However, many are concerned that this action plan isn't enough to bridge the gaps, preventing Canadians from acquiring safe, secure, and affordable housing, Wenzel reports. Ricardo Tranwan, a senior researcher at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives in Ontario, issued a statement on Thursday noting this is yet another budget without measures to curb the financialization of housing. Meanwhile, Brent Patterson investigates the funding for the military compared to other, arguably more, necessary programs in the federal budget. Budget 2022 has promised more than $8 billion in new funding for the military over 5 years, on top of $550 billion over 20 years that was promised in 2017, Patterson writes. In sharp contrast, over a 5-year period, only $5.3 billion will be spent on dental care. The proportionality of military spending, Patterson argues, is not a win that serves generations to come. It is not only unsatisfactory, it's arguably dangerous. Also on the site this week, a milestone no one wanted to recognize, this week Canada entered into its official sixth wave of COVID-19. Carl Nirenberg broke down Ontario's place in Canada's sixth wave and criticized the discourse between Ontario's government officials' approach to the mask mandate. While Peter Juni, the scientific director of Ontario's COVID-19 science advisory table, reports that the province now has 100,000 to 120,000 new COVID cases a day, masks in public spaces have not been required since March. At his Monday public appearance, Ontario's chief medical officer, Dr. Kiernan Moore, said he will recommend the government to extend the current mask mandate in high-risk settings, such as long care facilities, for another month month or so. That mandate is set to expire at the end of April. Moore will only go so far as to encourage all Ontarians to voluntarily wear masks, Nirenberg writes. That, it seems, is as much as his conservative political bosses will tolerate from him. Meanwhile, Kathy Crowe reflects on what the pandemic has taught us about how nursing is valued in Canada and how Ontario's government is failing its homeless population. At the beginning of the pandemic, Crowe reports 43 nurses were employed by Inner City Health Associates to work at Toronto's COVID-19 isolation recovery hotel, 7 of Toronto's shelter hotels, and to provide care at encampments across the city. By all accounts, these nurses provided exemplary care, Crowe wrote. I often said that the isolation and recovery hotel was the one COVID-19 response for homeless people that Toronto got right. That is, until they cut it. As of March 31st, those 43 nurses were terminated due to the planned ending of Ontario pandemic funding. Crowe wonders why the Inner City Health Associates would provide no warning to the broader community of Toronto. If this had taken place, advocates for the program could have asked the government to continue the funding. After all, these nursing cuts were made on the brink of Canada entering a sixth wave and also during a citywide shelter collapse. Governments have failed all nurses and the people who need them, Crowe argues. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on rabble.ca. And finally, Rabble is toasting to 21 years of progressive independent media. Since April 18, 2021, Rabble.ca has proudly maintained a focus on labor and worker rights, grassroots activism, and a progressive analysis on national politics. This Monday, April 18, we're celebrating our 21st anniversary. If you're a fan of the show and would like to celebrate with us, we'd love you to consider making a donation. Please visit our site for more information, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, simply click the link in our description. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel and Carl Nirenberg for their reporting this week, and to Carl, too, for supplying the music. And thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at CKUT 90.2 FM at McGill University in Montreal this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.